Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Good afternoon. My name is Professor Daniel Clay, and what I'll be addressing today is an analysis of Lockean philosophy in the historical and modern contexts of the development of and the jurisdictional restraints imposed by the statute of the International Criminal Court. So, to kind of give you an idea of where this all fits in and how it fits together is, for lack of better words, modern international criminal law is relatively silent as to its philosophical underpinnings. Right? Instead, we have to embrace different views, different theoretical perspectives to try to understand and try to at least wrap our heads around international criminal law. Now, my goal today is I'm going to look at three philosophers fairly quickly, Thomas Hobbes, Immanuel Kant, and then John Locke, with the ultimate emphasis being on John Locke. As you'll see, John Locke provides probably the greatest support for an ICC, for an international criminal tribunal. Although the scope of his vision, I would say, has yet to be fully realized. So, jumping in with the philosophers, if I can get there, to kind of follow up on Professor Sellers' great introduction, Thomas Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes obviously is a realist. He believed in the state of nature as a state of war, famously described it as being this nasty, brutish, and short. That being said, as Professor Sellers said just a minute ago, he did champion this notion of this kind of unquestionably strong sovereign, right? The people had to give up their individual rights, their individual identity, their kind of unbounded life in order for this restriction on state sovereignty. That being said, there was a grand bargain that takes place. Yes, the people have to give up their ultimate freedoms, but the state's entrusted with two eternal precepts, right? The first is to seek peace with other states, and the second is to ensure its natural right to defend itself, something that Hobbes thought was the ultimate act of state sovereignty. Now, to this end, Hobbes didn't necessarily oppose treaties, but he was cautiously optimistic about treaties. He only supported a treaty when there was a material common interest that really essentially kind of progressed society. So talking mail service, air service, things along those lines. But within that treaty, right, the treaty had to be limited enough that state retained the right to defend itself if it needed to do so. So when we think about Thomas Hobbes, we kind of see, and again, Professor hit this on the head, there's kind of an implicit rejection of an ultimate international sovereign. That being said, if we move down to Immanuel Kant, if we kind of think of these philosophers on a spectrum, you have Thomas Hobbes on one end, you have John Locke on the other end, Immanuel Kant's kind of flip-floppy in the middle. Kant was a transcendental idealist who yielded a form of empirical realism to whom he believed that both states and individuals were in a state of nature, right? And that state of nature was a state of war, but it wasn't the state of war that Thomas Hobbes envisioned, where there was constant fighting, or where it was nasty, brutish, and short. Instead, for Kant, his state of nature, his state of war, was one of fear. Right? And from that kind of state of fear, he comes through and says, look, think about how states deal with situations, how they resolve conflicts. States do not go to court. Right? The quote is, let's see what's on here. States do not plead their case before a tribunal. Instead, war alone is their way of bringing suit. Right, so for him, he says that's how states deal with and resolve any issues that they have. So he calls upon the international community, specifically liberal republics, to adopt peace treaties and peace organizations. However, there's one caveat. Yes, he calls for the adoption of peace organizations, but not at the expense of state sovereignty, which kind of negates the peace organization. So we see Kant is supportive of treaties that are a little bit more in terms of governance of war, or in terms of governance of the rules of war, as opposed to just the civil society. And then we jump to the obviously most important, Mr. John Locke. Locke was this idealist. He envisioned a basis of international norms derived from natural law and positive law that regulate conflict and cooperation. Specifically, Locke created a implicit international regulatory scheme that consisted of two parts. Right? The first part is the positive law, so treaties, accords, etc. And the second part of this international scheme to promote peace was an indifferent judge, also called a common authority, with the authority to determine all differences according to established law. Now, this authority would be able to hear disputes between not just liberal republics, but also non-liberal republics, again, have that ultimate authority to determine all disputes. However, if there is this ultimate authority to determine all disputes, states do have to surrender at least part of their sovereignty, right? Because they have to utilize this mechanism. So kind of keeping that in the back of our heads, just the brief overview, let's talk about how the ICC really developed philosophically. So there's really, in the modern era, there's really three distinct times that the ICC was considered. One thing I'd point out is treaties governing warfare were relatively rare prior to the 19th century. Right, and say governing warfare, we're talking about the actual rules of war as opposed to peace organizations, peace treaties. Instead, we see this Hobbesian-styled state sovereignty. That is until a pairing of Gustave Monnier, who is the co-founder of the Red Cross, Henri Durant, and a bunch of benefactors who convinced a handful of states to convene to discuss possible rules of war, rules of engagement. And what we see is the Geneva International Diplomatic Conference of 1863. And we see coming from that is one of the first kind of modern statements of rules of war. It established the Red Cross logo that most of us are familiar with, prevented a shooting of medics, required medics to treat sides equally, not to favor their side over another side, things along those lines. Now, while this kind of seems very at a high level kind of Kantian, right, because we have this kind of peace treaty feel, at the end of the day, it's not. Because Kant was about preventing war, not necessarily dictating the rules of engagement. So similarly, it cannot be said that the 12 ratifying states adopted an implicit Lockean perspective, because there was no enforcement mechanism. When we read the diaries of Henri Durant, Gustave Monnier, he initially contemplated a criminal court or some kind of body that would hold individual soldiers accountable for breaking the covenants of the Geneva Convention. But he thought, no, better just leave this up to the public. He thought that public pressure and the press would be enough to convince states to do the right thing and try their own soldiers. Well, what we end up seeing is this ends in an abysmal failure. What we see is the Franco-Prussian War, during which both sides, who were both parties to this treaty, just basically tear it up and throw it away. Right, so we see the kidnapping of doctors, shooting of medics. We see false flags using the false Red Cross, things along those lines. So we see this really, really significant failure of something that could have been overtly positive. Now, that being said, In response, when you're, again, reading his diaries, which he kept meticulously, goes back in and says, you know what? I was wrong. There should be some kind of international criminal court. And at the first, or excuse me, at a meeting of the International Red Cross, Gustave Monnier actually proposes an international criminal court. Well, in response, we have scholars and states who ultimately just reject it based upon state-style sovereignty. Right? And so Gustave Monnier ends up ultimately defeated, and he writes that an international body to adjudicate crimes could never happen. Right? So it's kind of a sad, sad tale of Gustave Monnier. But it gets better because the next consideration is World War I, right? Happy, happy topics. So World War I, this is next consideration. Specifically during the Paris Peace Conference, under pressure from the public and the press, Gustave Monnier's original idea, two states actually flipped and said, okay, we're willing to give up our state-style sovereignty in exchange for more Lockean values. Oddly enough, it was the United States and Britain. And we're going to see that the United States obviously becomes a huge problem and thorn in the side of the ICC when it finally does get created. So this marks a major shift. Right, the first time that we really see states say, okay, we are willing to give up a significant portion of our sovereignty for one adjudicatory body. That being said, because of internal relationships and the fact that the rest of the states didn't want to give up their state-style sovereignty, it didn't happen. That instead, what we do get out of the Paris Peace Conference is we get the Permanent Court of International Justice. Now, this is very Kantian in nature because it's tasked essentially with trying to keep the peace. Right? So the court has jurisdiction, does not have jurisdiction to adjudicate individual offenders, but instead it's called upon to adjudicate disputes between states, to interpret treaties, things along those lines that would have in the past normally led to some sort of war. Right? So we kind of see a Kantian style, almost Hobbesian style change. Well, that sets the stage for World War II. After World War II, everything changes. After witnessing the atrocities of World War II, what we end up seeing is the International Criminal Court, applicable to individual offenders, started to receive sustained political momentum. To this end, the United Nations, as a newly minted body, a Kantian-styled body, many I think would argue, created a treaty with the ultimate goal of preventing war, adopted a series of conventions, including the 1948 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. And as you heard earlier today, this essentially tasked the International Law Commission with establishing whether or not a permanent international criminal court would be appropriate and how to go about it. Well, about 50 years pass until anything really comes out of the International Law Commission due to the Cold War, due to various interventions. We don't really see much movement until 1994. So finally, in 1994, we get the draft statute that's ultimately going to be debated at the Rome Conference. Now, when the Rome Conference is convened, you have this problem of trying to get 160 states who want to do what appears to be competing things. One, retain their Hobbesian-styled sovereignty, and two, embrace the principles of John Locke and his notion of the protection of the innocent. Now, despite the United States being a thorn in the side of these negotiations, ultimately, we do get the ICC, but it's at an expense. So as negotiations were occurring, the United States kept asking for more and more jurisdictional limitations, things that would provide it a way out, a way that its individuals would not be held accountable at the ICC level, the state could retain sovereignty, etc. So let's look at that. So we see the jurisdictional restraints. if we think about them in the context of them being really Lockean in nature, overview of Lockean in nature, but executed through a Hobbesian style means, right? So what we see when we go through the Rome Statute is the preamble includes protection of the innocent, and then it subsequently provides Locke's first requirement, which was positive law. Granted, there's only three crimes, but at least it provides some kind of positive law. But where the issue comes into play here is, does it provide for a common judge or a common authority? Under complementary jurisdiction, which was one of the very first things that was debated during the Rome Conference, right? The ICC obviously will take a step back if a state is legitimately investigating or prosecuting a case. Well, that kind of creates a problem, because now instead of having one common authority, we have 161 common authorities, or authorities who can adjudicate these cases. So to that end, it's difficult to say that the court has a common, or is a common judge. So we've met the first part of Locke's theoretical perspective, the positive law, but not necessarily the second part. So what does this mean? Well, what this means is there's an inherent weakness in the ICC. And it really has two roads it can go down, two options that it can choose. One, it can choose to continue this Hobbesian-style state sovereignty and embrace ad hoc tribunals and kind of be this more or less powerless body. Or it can try to step up, embrace Lockean perspectives as being a common judge. Obviously, this requires the states to buy into that notion, but that's where we're at. Now, one thing that we might see is, and I think this has been raised earlier today, some might argue that we're starting to see a rise of Hobbesian-styled sovereignty concerns again, specifically with the African Union, its non-binding resolution to withdraw from the ICC earlier this year. Luckily, that the African Union withdrawing is not enough to facilitate the collapse of the ICC, but it is enough to delegitimize it to a point of being unstable and encouraging other states to withdraw. So, that being said, most research that I did for this paper suggests that society is instead trending towards John Locke's kind of vision of how international governance should work. So while we see this non-binding resolution, and it's important that it's a non-binding resolution, what we see is other states realize that they do not have the capability, they don't have the capacity, they don't have the means to really adjudicate these type of cases. So that being said, while this recognition occurs at the expense of state sovereignty, it's as noted by John Locke, when all cannot be preserved, the protection of the innocent is to be preferred. And that is that.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.